Good evening. It's a very great pleasure to introduce Adair Turner a second time to give a second lecture based on this great book which he's writing on the future of global capitalism. As you know, Adair was Director General of the CBI until Christmas, and he's joining Schroeder's in the autumn, and in the meantime he's just writing a book. He's also a visiting professor at the LSE and a member, I'm happy to say, of the Centre for Economic Performance. He's going to talk for up to an hour, but we'll have time for questions and debate after that. Those of you who were here when Carlo De Benedetti was talking, I can assure you there will be no sonic boom because Adair has not arrived in his private aeroplane, and therefore he's not been able to bring his private television crew with their roving mic. So Adair is going to talk to us about the new economy, or more specifically, where will the new jobs come from, the impact of technological change on the labour market. Adair.
Well, thank you very much, Richard, and good evening. As Richard has said, the publicised title of my lecture is The Impact of Technology on Employment, Where Will the Jobs Come From? Like I suspect many people when you're setting a lecture title, it was fixed in rather of a hurry several months ago, probably when someone said, look, we've got to put out the publicity this evening, will you please tell us a title? In fact, I've probably drifted a little bit from the narrow definition of the original title, and what I'd like to talk about this evening is not just the issue of technology on job creation, though that is included, but rather some thoughts on how the overall shape of mature economies is changing under the influence of three forces at work: globalization, technology, and the rise of the service economy, changes including, in particular, the implications for job creation. So the title now stands Globalization, Technology, and the Service Economy, Implications for Job Creation, and it'll just about do. I want to start with an observation about intellectual fashion. At any one time, policy debates on economics tend to be driven by a dominant theme, by dominant assumptions about the major forces at work. What is truly striking, looking back only over 10 years, is how rapidly and completely those dominant themes of discussion change. Only 10 years ago, in the late 80s and early 90s, one dominant theme was the inherent superiority of stakeholder economies. Japanese and German manufacturing capability totally triumphant because more long-termist and investment-oriented. The Anglo-Saxons, you remember, had to change. 5 years ago, in the mid-1990s, it was all about the Asian threat. Relentless tides of global competition were hitting the US and Europe from low-cost, low-income Asian tigers, and we better rise to the challenge, tighten our belts, cut costs, or simply fade away. Partly true of the US, above all true of Europe. But then in 1997, Asia crashed, and suddenly numerous commentators who had previously failed to share with us their insights sprang forth to explain that the Asian tigers, far from being paragons of free market virtue, were in fact disaster zones of crony capitalism and untransparent accounting and corporate governance. The Asian tigers clearly had to change to survive, to become more free market, more like America. But then along came autumn 1998, global financial volatility, global fears of credit crunch. Paul Krugman wrote The Return of Depression Economics. George Soros, having made a fortune out of speculating in short-term liquid financial markets, warned us in the crisis of global capitalism that short-term global financial markets were always almost certain to destroy us. His Stop Me or I Will Kill Again book, as it's been called. And John Gray was happy to report that the false dawn, the delusions of global capitalism, could now be cast onto the rubbish heap of history. The global financial markets had to change, and presidents and prime ministers made a series of thoughtful speeches about the world need for a new world financial architecture. But only 15 months later, it all seems like a bad dream. For suddenly, we are not on the brink of an impending crisis. We are marching joyously into a new economic paradigm, the paradigm of the net, of the dot-com, with productivity growth rising, inflation dangers dispelled, and the only relevant question, Don't you get it? At very least, I think that history should make us deeply suspicious of each new twist of fashion in the economic policy debate. As the overall story has changed, so too have the specific assertions made about employment creation and unemployment, and about the relative success of different countries in creating and defending employment. The assertion popular in the mid-1990s, at the time of the great fear of the Asian threat, saw employment defence and employment creation as above all about competitiveness in the face of the fierce world of global competition. The second, more recent development of this, still uses the rhetoric of competitiveness, of winning in a competitive race, but with the particular focus on information technology, on winning in the knowledge economy, and on the need to educate everybody in that knowledge economy in order to compete and to create employment. It's around these two categories of assertions about employment creation that I'd like to structure my remarks this evening. The two assertions actually share some common underpinning theory, indeed some common underpinning fallacies. But the second is both more current and more interesting because more nearly right in at least some respects, whereas the former stems from almost total conceptual confusion. I will therefore be far briefer in my comments on assertion one, the dominant belief of 1994 to 97, using it only to establish some general conceptual points also relevant in relation to assertion two. The global economic threat school of thought, so popular in the mid-1990s, was characterized by the sort of propositions set out on this chart. First, that the world economy is becoming relentlessly more global, with more and more sectors open to global competition, not just in goods, but in services too. Not just electronics from Taiwan, but software and online reservation services from Bangalore. Second proposition was that this competition from lower income and more competitive countries poses a threat to both the prosperity and employment of the rich West, a proposition popularized by Lester Thoreau's book, Head to Head, depicting a world of intense competition in which for every winner there must be a loser, in which high-paid American jobs are taken over by Asian competitors and replaced by lower-paid service jobs. And thirdly, a European-specific subset of the theory, with Europe uncompetitive, its costs too high, its public sectors too large, its taxation too onerous, and suffering high unemployment because of this failure of competitiveness. The trouble with each of these propositions is that they are largely nonsense, or as Paul Krugman memorably termed them, globaloney. And I will not belabor the reasons why these propositions, and indeed the whole concept of global competition between nations rather than companies, is deeply theoretically flawed, since those arguments were so well set out in Krugman's book, Pop Internationalism. Briefly, however, the world is not a zero-sum game in which some must win and others lose, either in terms of prosperity or in terms of employment. And the very concept of country competitiveness, even in the externally traded sectors of the economy, is meaningless outside the specification of an exchange rate, and exchange rates can and will move over time to offset imbalances in external position. And finally, the only way that developments in international trade can lead, at least temporarily, to a fall in a country's national income is via an adverse movement in the terms of trade, higher import prices relative to exports, the precise opposite of the falling import prices which so concerned the devotees of the Asian competitiveness threat theory. So we are dealing, as has been well set out before, with deep conceptual confusion, but also with empirical misunderstanding. For it is simply not true that economies are becoming relentlessly more global, if by that we mean an increase in trade intensity. And the reasons why it is not true are worth a little exploration, since they tell us something about the forces at work shaping our overall economy, forces relevant more generally to the issues of employment creation. Looking at the European Union 15, for instance, overall trade intensity, and the figures on the left of the chart include intra-European trade between France and Germany, between Germany and Italy, did indeed rise significantly between the early 60s and the early 80s, long before we all chattered on about globalization. But since the early 80s, they have actually oscillated year by year on a path up and down with various movements in the business cycle, but with no clear trend. It fell in the late 80s, it's up in the last several years, but it's only actually returned to the trade intensities we achieved 15 years ago. And of that 27.6% of trade as a percentage of GDP in the EU 15, 62% is intra-European, and another 16.5% is with other rich countries, the US, Japan, Switzerland, Norway, leaving only 6%, 5.9% of GDP traded with lower and middle income countries. A percentage actually slightly down over the last 15 years, and a percentage which includes not only manufactured goods, but major raw material flows such as oil, which is one of the reasons why it actually moves quite a lot, that final percentage, with the oil price. The fact is that the vast majority of economic activity in a rich developed economy is either internal to that economy or involves trade with other countries of a similar income level. And that as a result, the influence of on developed world economics of manufactured imports from low-income countries is, for empirical as well as theoretical reasons, vastly smaller than writers like Lester Thoreau suggested. Many people, however, find these facts of constant trade intensity counterintuitive, or at least counter to what they've heard. For what we hear of year by year is of greater trade intensity in particular sectors. And that really is true. There really are more car parts from Egypt or Brazil, more software services from India. And we also hear, year by year, of trade volume growth well above GDP growth. And that sounds like it has to mean increasing trade intensity. So that if we look at what happened between 1984 to 1997, it is indeed true for the European Union 15 that real GDP grew by 33%, while trade volume growth in the official statistics grew by 97%. And that sounds like it makes static trade intensity mathematically impossible, the numerator growing faster than the denominator, but the ratio staying constant, which indeed it would be, but for the influence of relative prices. For the fact is that if the prices of traded goods and services had grown over that period in line with all prices in the economy, trade intensity would indeed have soared between 1984 and 1997. In fact, it would have gone from 29% to 42% of GDP. What in fact occurred, however, was that that volume effect was almost exactly offset by a relative price fall. The prices of traded goods and services relentlessly falling relative to the price of general goods and services throughout the whole of the economy. And that reflects the fact of relative productivity growth. For our economies are characterized, for some fundamental technological reasons, by large divergences in attainable productivity rates sector by sector. Productivity growth rates are higher where there are standard processes characterized by economies of scale and opportunities for process redesign. They are lower wherever there are face-to-face service aspects to service delivery. They are high in television manufacture, but they're low in primary school education. Indeed, it is an overt aim of government policy to reduce productivity in primary school education, because that is what a lower pupil-staff ratio means in economic terms. It is high in basic data processing, such as retail financial services. It is low in quality restaurant meals. And as a result, it is high in traded sectors and low in non-traded sectors, because the very factors that make goods and services more inherently tradable also make them more inherently susceptible to rapid productivity growth. Yes, the information and communications technology makes possible global competition in some categories of service, such as back office processing, but the very factors that make them susceptible to global competition also make them susceptible to rapid productivity growth and to relative price collapse compared with difficult to trade services like nursing care or hairdressing. So some economic sectors are indeed more and more intensely traded across the world. Within specific sectors, and this is how it looks to individual business people, globalization and intense competition is absolutely for real. But the impact of this on aggregate trade intensity is continually offset by the rise in economic importance of non-traded service-intensive sectors of the economy, restaurants and healthcare, education and sports centers, rising in importance to a large extent simply because they are less susceptible to productivity growth and automation. So a lot of the theory of the competitiveness threat was wrong, and the empirical descriptions of a relentlessly more traded world economy were also wrong. And not surprisingly, as a result, the European-specific subset of the story is also quite wrong, with the idea that high European unemployment relative to the US can be meaningfully linked to a failure of external competitiveness simply mistaken and out of line with the empirical facts, both because the supposedly uncompetitive European economies are and were throughout the 1990s running large current account surpluses, not a sign of intelligent economic policy, but at least a warning light to anyone seeking to advance the theory of a crisis of European competitiveness, and because if we look at differences in employment rates sectorally between the US and the EU, we see that all of the employment rate difference is concentrated in services rather than manufacturing, and that within services, it is primarily concentrated in untraded sectors such as health, education, retailing, wholesaling, hotels, cafes, restaurants. High European unemployment in the 1990s is explained by a combination of low levels of domestic demand growth and more fundamentally by structural labour market features which have impeded the employment intensity of economic growth. The idea that it is well explained in terms of competitiveness is simply wrong. And indeed, one key step in thinking clearly about economic performance and in particular about employment creation is to free our minds entirely from the confusions of globaloney, which is not to deny in any way the importance of some globalization effects. The globalization of competition within specific traded sectors is a vital factor for individual companies within those sectors. Globalization of capital flows and of idea flows, best practice flows, is highly relevant in all factors, sectors, non-traded as much as traded, and can be a major stimulus of accelerated structural change and productivity growth. And global short-term financial flows do indeed pose specific dangers which we would be unwise to assume have gone away simply because the markets have been quieter since the autumn of 1998. So there's an awful lot to analyse, debate and consider in globalisation. There are some tremendously powerful and important forces at work. But the idea of global competition between countries rather than companies was a 1990s red herring which we need to reject. For a country, external competitiveness is not the fundamental challenge, or even a particularly relevant challenge, but there are instead two fundamentals of economic success: achieving a high productivity growth rate in all sectors of the economy, traded or non-traded equally, and attaining a low rate of involuntary unemployment. Two challenges independent of any concept of external competitiveness, and two challenges largely independent of each other, it being quite possible for a country to be pretty good at one of those dimensions, but poor on the other. It's that framework which we need to keep in mind as we turn to the second set of assertions about economic performance and job creation, the assertions linked to the knowledge-based economy. The knowledge-based economy, the new paradigm, the latest all-enveloping theme of economic policy discourse. Among the propositions advanced here are the following. First, that changes in information and communication technology now in hand are not just an other wave of technological change, but singularly and distinctly profound, creating a new paradigm, increasing potential productivity growth significantly and transforming industry structures. Second, in a new version of the old competitiveness argument, it is argued that Europe faces a competitiveness gap versus the US and must close it to compete effectively. Thirdly, a favourite with politicians because it helps to legitimate the acceptance of change, that while information and communications technologies, of course, destroy jobs, they also create them. And fourthly, the idea that this revolution affects all companies and has implications for all employees and skills, that all companies will be internet companies and all workers knowledge workers. Well, are these assertions true? Well, I'm going to come back to that to at least suggest some answers shortly. But I'm going to first of all take a detour to set some context, a context within which we can better understand the likely impact of the ICT revolution, if indeed it is a revolution. And the detour is to describe what was really going on up to about 1997, before we all discovered that we ought to be focusing on a new paradigm. If the talk of a global struggle for existence was a delusion, what was really happening in the mature economies, and what in particular was happening to employment? Well, what was happening was, above all, the growth of the service economy. Services in the US, in national income terms, growing from 62% of GDP in 1960 to 76% in 1997 at the expense of manufacturing, mining, and agriculture. But actually, that's an incredibly unuseful statement, because services defined at that level actually covers a huge range of quite different activities, and actually, interestingly, includes several which aren't really services at all. In fact, services, as it is usually expressed when you say it's 70% of GDP, simply means it's linked only by the fact, those services are linked only by the fact that they're not manufacturing, they're not construction, and they're not agriculture. There is basically almost no commonality other than that. And so to understand the growth of the service economy in the US and in Europe, because it is generic to all rich countries, we need in fact to distinguish three distinct elements of what is going on. The first two both reflect changing customer preference, but the third is quite different in nature, in cause and in consequence. The service economy has grown, first of all, because as people get richer, an increasing share of consumer demand tends to get spent on services, not on goods. More restaurant meals rather than an endless increase in the number of washing machines you own. Secondly, the service economy has grown because when people do buy physical goods, when they go to a physical store, a retail store, and buy physical goods, more of the value added has tended to shift into the distribution and servicing and out of the manufacturing per se. What is consumed is still a physical good, but we count retailing and wholesaling as services because the value added has moved down the value added chain. Finally, the service economy has grown, and this is a quite unrelated development, which simply happens to have been simultaneous. It has grown because of the result of the vertical disintegration of companies with business functions in all sectors of the economy outsourced and subcontracted. These are three distinct factors. The first two, both linked because they are shifts in customer preference. The third, a really quite unrelated development, but one which simply occurred at the same time. Let's look a little bit more detail at those. Richer people spend an increasing share of income on more services rather than more physical goods. That is true if you look at income deciles, cross-sectional, at any given point of time, and it's true, as this slide shows, through time. If you look at household consumption in the UK, since 1960, about 20% of British household expenditure has shifted from goods to two categories of what national income accounts call services. Firstly, to a wide range of real services, such as catering, transport, communication, tourism, personal services, etc. And second, to the purchase or renting of housing, also defined as a service in national income terms, but actually in many ways a third category yet, separate from either current goods or current services, a category of expenditure where increased expenditure represents primarily competition for a limited second-hand stock of positional goods, resulting in a relative price increase rather than a shift in actual volumes consumed and thus in the volume of supporting economic activity and employment. Having said that, and I think it's an important factor which is not adequately explained, I will leave that aside and not come back to the housing part of the story. But the overall message is clear. As people get richer, they tend to spend their income more on services rather than on goods, more restaurants rather than more washing machines. And wherever the decisions are driven by individual choice, more on healthcare and education as well. This slide shows medical care expenditure as a percentage of household expenditure in the US on a strong and apparently relentless upward trend. And wherever you have health not primarily paid for privately, but publicly provided, we see continual electoral pressure for increased public healthcare expenditure. What we have there between the British and the American systems is a customer preference for healthcare reflected in a different fashion, one through the ballot box, the other through the wallet. But the basic fact is the same, a shift in customer preference, more healthcare more important than more television sets. Though, again, a little caveat, because it's interesting to note that it isn't actually just about customer preference per se, or at least it's a somewhat difficult to interpret or describe subtle mix of customer preference and of the relative productivity and prices effect that we've already explored. Take, for example, catering services and durable goods in the UK. From 1980 to 1998, British GDP grew in real terms by 53%, and general prices grew by 139%. Durable goods demand in volume terms, meanwhile, actually grew faster than real GDP. It grew 140%, according to the figures, and faster than catering, which grew 77%. But what happened was that the price of durable goods grew by only 62%. It therefore fell significantly in relative terms, while catering services went up by 215%. And it's that relative price effect, rooted in productivity effects, which over this period made catering rise relative to durable goods as a percentage of GDP. It's the same relative productivity effect we saw earlier. The relentless tendency of technologically driven productivity growth in some sectors of the economy to overwhelm the volume growth, with consumer expenditure and economic activity continually shifting as a result to the sectors where productivity growth is either more difficult to achieve or indeed most difficult to define. So that's the customer preference and relative price side of the story, a shift in what we actually produce and what we consume and in what people actually do for a living, whether they are plant operators or nurses, farmers or shop workers. The third element, vertical disintegration, is different in nature and in some senses less fundamental, even though its impact on the measured labour force composition over the last 10 years in the US has actually been more dramatic. Between 1988 and 1999, as this slide shows, business services in the US grew from 6.5% to 9.4% of total employment, creating, in some sense, 4 million new jobs and indeed exceeding the growth of personnel service-related employment over that period. What this business service growth reflects, however, is not new consumer demands for different goods and services, nor a shift of value along the value chain, nor indeed new activities for the individual workers involved. It reflects instead vertical disintegration of companies in all sectors of the economy, outsourcing of a huge variety of business functions, from computer source processing and software development to market research and strategic planning activities to security guards and catering and other building services. Indeed, the biggest employment increase in any of the US Bureau of Labor Statistics individual lines for those years is in a category called personnel supply, effectively the supply of people to do whatever job you want. Not actually a new set of economic activities, but a new category of employment contract. And therefore, in some senses, less fundamental and less interesting in terms of macroeconomic structure or in terms of skill requirements than the other two key drivers of service sector growth, which are actually related to what people want to buy and what people have to do in order to deliver it. Though, with, I believe, this disintegration, some very important indirect consequences, often not adequately explored, to which I'm going to come back later. Whatever the consequences of the vertical disintegration effect, however, it's clear that the shift to a service and services-intensive economy has involved a significant change in labour market composition, in skills needed, and in relative incomes, a change with important policy implications. For it seems likely that the shift to a service and servicing-intensive economy has increased the degree of labour market flexibility required to achieve a reasonably high level of employment. For three reasons. First of all, because in service and servicing provision, unlike in goods provision, delivery has to occur at the time of customer demand. You cannot batch, and that increases the demand for part-time and temporary work. Secondly, because the service and servicing intensive economies seems to be characterized by a widening dispersion in the relative marginal productivity of different categories of labor, increasing, therefore, the degree of wage rate flexibility required to deliver full employment, especially at low-income levels. And thirdly, I think an important one, this, in the bottom right-hand corner, service-intensive functions are characterized far more than manufacturing functions by a wide degree of managerial freedom to make multiple minor trade-offs between higher levels of employment and higher levels of customer service. Basically, adding marginal extra people in a factory would simply mean that they get in the way. It wouldn't make the product any better. But in most service levels, face-to-face service areas, there are endless opportunities to add marginal people. Extra staff in a retail store or a pub reduce your queue length or give you packed rather than unpacked bags, delivering incremental service levels which customers will value, but which don't have to be provided, which aren't inherent to the nature of the service, and which therefore will not be provided if employment laws or wage-fixing processes or the panoply of different factors which determine in total the degree of labour market flexibility are too restrictive. For all these reasons, it seems likely that the move to a service and service-intensive economy requires an increasing degree of labour market flexibility to achieve reasonable levels of unemployment, and that one key cause of Europe's inferior employment performance in the 1980s and 90s compared with the US or the UK was not so much that Europe became more inflexible, but that it failed to achieve the increases in flexibility required by changing economic structure. Certainly, as we've seen, Europe's unemployment performance problem was concentrated exclusively in service sectors. More specifically, Europe employs a far lower percentage of the working population in two key sectors. First of all, in HoReCa, that is hotels, cafes, and retailing for the uninitiated. And here, I think, the hypothesis of inadequate labour market flexibility very strongly applies. Secondly, I think interesting and probably inadequately explored, in education, health, and social work. Might sound a bit surprising, but that's what the figures show. Sectors where I think the argument of the hypothesis of an inadequate labour market flexibility apply to a degree, but where there are other factors probably at work which need to be explored. Finally, of course, Europe employs much fewer people in business and financial services, a sign simply that the process of vertical disintegration has progressed less far, though not an effect which should logically be a contributory factor in explaining total employment differences, because it ought to be a difference in where people are employed by company, not what functions they are inherently employed in. So, to end on my detour, where does that leave us all in 1997, as the new paradigm wave began to get going? Well, with these four conclusions. One, that mature economies get ever more service intensive as customer preference shifts and as we get relentlessly more productive at producing physical goods. Two, that employment growth comes entirely from service sector growth and is often concentrated in the face-to-face service activities which are least amenable to productivity improvement. Three, that Europe's failure in the 1980s and 90s was that its growth was much less job-intensive than the US, even though it was actually growing as fast in per capita terms. It is an intriguing analysis to start in 1983, when the unemployment rates of the European Union and the US were exactly the same at 9.3%, to then track 14 years in which they grew at almost exactly the same per capita growth rate, but with this very major divergence between the employment performance of Europe and the employment performance of the US. So that in terms of those different challenges of economic policy I talked about earlier, Europe indeed is, if anything, doing better on the productivity challenge, or was up until 1996 or so, than the US. The US was doing better on the employment creation side. And four, final conclusion, that Europe's job creation failure was to a degree explained by inadequate labour market flexibility to facilitate employment creation in the increasingly service and servicing intensive world. A reasonable assessment, I think, 3 or 4 years ago of what was going on. And then came along our new fashion, the new paradigm, and the propositions we've already seen. So are they true, and what do they imply for employment? Well, I think the starting point is to note that there are indeed features about information and communications technology which are distinctive and which we would expect to have a very profound economic effect. Three factors in particular and in combination. The first is pervasiveness. Information and communications technology, ICT, isn't a technology relevant to one specific industry or sector. It sort of gets everywhere, potentially improving productivity and performance in almost every sector. Now, we have actually seen that before with a technology. Electricity, for instance, was rather similar. It's a pervasive technology which sort of got everywhere in the economy. So it's not distinctive, but it is distinctive when you combine it with factor two. Because factor two is the pace of basic technological advance, which in ICT is literally an order of magnitude, literally 10 times faster than the pace of technological advance, which we saw, for instance, in the electrical mechanical revolution. Performance per price doubling every 18 months, and indeed, if anything, over the last few years, seeming to run ahead of that rate. The cost of computing per kilobit of processing power likely to fall by 98% in the next 10 years. Between 1985 and 95, available transmission speeds increasing by four times, but by 2005, likely to have increased by another 45 times. So that many of you will know the analogy that if the automotive industry had achieved over the last 30 years the same pace of increase as the IT industry, the average family car would now cost $5 and would do 200,000 miles to the gallon. Finally, factor three, information and communications technology is particularly interesting to economists precisely because it affects information processing and information exchange. And information plays a vital role in market economies. The relative efficiency of information flows between and within firms affects the optimal degree of vertical integration, the optimal size of the firm. Change the economics of information exchange, and we should expect big changes in industry structure. Degrees of market perfection, meanwhile, are to a significant extent a function of information adequacy. Change the economics of information exchange, and you expect significant changes in the price searching and price fixing processes and in relative economic power of different players in markets. So overall, we have a pervasive technology improving at a rate an order of magnitude faster than most other technologies, addressing economic activities central to the determination of industry structure and market behavior, and addressing a very large slice of existing economic activity. Because when you think about economic activity, a huge proportion of it is actually not involved with the inherent activities required to deliver the goods or services that customers actually value, but with monitoring and communicating and meeting and administrating, with placing orders and invoicing and accounting. All activities peculiarly susceptible to ICT-based productivity improvements, and all activities to the disappearance of which the consumer would be completely indifferent. There are a lot of these activities. Indeed, McKinsey and Company have estimated that these interactive activities account for 51% of total economic activity, total GDP in the US. Now, this is the sort of heroic quantification which my former colleagues at McKinsey really excel at. And indeed, to say that it is 51% and not 43% or 63% requires both heroic courage in one's estimation assumptions and some highly debatable conceptual issues. So I'm not going to argue that it's 50% rather than 40% or 60%, but the key point is it's very, very big. And so we have a technology growing at a distinctive pace, addressing a huge slice of present economic activity, a formula for very significant economic change, and for significant change in employment patterns. But with the nature of that change, perhaps paradoxical to some of the devotees of the ever more knowledge-intensive economy school of thought. For the direct employment impact of technological change depends on a balance of two factors. First of all, up the vertical axis, the rapidity of technological change, and then on the horizontal axis, the extent to which the new technology generates, creates new demand. If you have a technology towards the bottom right-hand chart of this chart, where the new demand creation is high and the rapidity of technological change a bit slower, that will tend to actually increase, create direct employment. A technology towards the top left reduces direct employment because the pace of technological growth exceeds the pace of new consumer demand created. And what it does there is it frees up resources to do other quite unrelated things. Put a few on the map. Agricultural technology, the agricultural revolution throughout this century, was clearly in the top left-hand side. Its moderately rapid pace of technological advance, combining with minimal aggregate new demand creation, because it was not an income-elastic good, its economic benefit deriving almost entirely from fewer people employed in agriculture and from the resources thus freed up to go away and do somewhere else completely unrelated things. The automotive industry, at least until about 1980 or 1990, was in a different category. Up until that stage, new demand creation outstripping the pace of productivity improvement, increasing numbers of people employed in the world auto industry, though I think the balance of that has changed around in the last 10 years. Where will ICT be? Well, we know it's right at the very top in terms of the rapidity of technological change. The issue is, where is it in terms of demand creation? Is this primarily a technology which simply automates away existing economic functions, freeing up resources to do other things, or is it a technology which in and of itself directly creates new categories of consumer demand that in some direct sense creates jobs as well as destroys them? Well, it's certainly a industry, a set of economic activities, which is growing in economic performance. US estimates suggest that all of the ICT providing industries combined, and this is a combination of all telecommunication companies and all computer hardware companies and all software companies and all people involved in computer processing and related services. It's a combination which the US government has done, pulling together all reasonable categories of ICT industries. These now account for 8.2% of GDP in 1999, up from 5.8% in 1990. And those are the figures which justify statements of the type which you hear, that while ICT is still less than 10% of GDP, it's a quarter or a third of the increase in GDP over the last few years. But what is this ICT activity? Is it about improving the efficiency of existing economic functions or about delivering a new customer values? The answer is, to a huge extent, the former. ICT investment is now calculated to be 43.6% of total US plant and equipment investment. Almost half of all business investment, the fundamental motor of productivity improvement, is about improved information and communications, hardware and software and services. But turning to the consumption side, only 2.4%, and I did check this several times because it does seem a bit slow, and I see somebody worrying with their head wagging there in the audience, only 2.4% of total personal consumption is spent on the consumer products and services of the ICT industry. All the mobile hardware and services that people buy, all the PCs and software, all the internet connections and usage, 2.4% of their personal consumption. So far, ICT is a huge event in business investment, but in the total scheme of things, a relatively small event in individual consumption patterns, albeit that 2.4 still manages to make Michael Dell a very, very rich man in the provision of personal computers. And that balance has a consequence for where jobs are going to come from. On the investment side, the issue is whether all this investment is going to deliver the productivity improvements which the inherent nature of this technology would lead us to expect. After all, it has to be a question, because after all, ICT investment has not only recently gone to 40% of total investment, it's actually been running at about that percentage for at least 10 years, perhaps for longer. And indeed, the really big ramp up in expenditure on hardware occurred during the 1970s rather than over the last 20 years. But until recently, that appeared to be without a major impact on productivity growth, so that until just a few years ago, the common adage was that IT is everywhere except in the productivity statistics. But that does seem to have changed in the last few years, and I think changed significantly enough, and now for a long enough period, that it's a reasonable inference that sustainable productivity growth has increased somewhat for at least a number of years. Not the laws of economics dispelled and disappeared, not the end forever of inflation, but perhaps a 10-year period in which sustainable productivity growth rates may be perhaps 0.5% higher than we saw in the 1980s. And we've seen those fluctuations before. Productivity growth rates in the US were higher in the 1960s than they were in the 1950s. They do vary decade by decade. If that's really true, why is it now occurring and not in the 1980s? Well, I suggest three factors. Firstly, because we are simply buying more and more ICT capability. The percentage of total investment may not have risen much, but that's basically because it's just getting very, very cheap. But for every dollar we spend, we are getting immensely more capability in hardware due to the relentless progress of that 18 months rule, price performance doubling every 18 months, and more capability in software, with huge strides in software development methodologies now dramatically cutting the cost and the lead time of new productivity enhancement investment. That's one factor. The second factor is, I think, that ICT now includes, far more than 10 years ago, a large element of C, of communications, with huge improvements in the interconnectivity of information systems, the web itself, but also lots of intranets, creating major opportunities for process redesign between companies rather than just within them. And the third factor, more speculative, but I throw it in, because of a spin-off from the outsourcing and subcontracting wave we saw earlier, a completely unintended consequence, but perhaps an important one. Because what that outsourcing wave in the US has created is an army of professional subcontractors employed no longer as middle managers within one company and dedicated to jealously guarding every process improvement that that company comes up with. But when you get outsourcing, those people serve many companies and you create a tremendously powerful force for the accelerated transfer of best practice within companies. From a combination of cheaper hardware, more efficient software, and a whole industry devoted to the process of best transfer, I think we have, at least for a period of time, just very accelerated and improved mechanisms for improving productivity in many basic functions. For all those reasons, I think the productivity spurt is going to be for real and will be significant for a useful number of years. I have no science to this, but 0.5% for 10 years strikes me as a sensible midway point between the overcautious doubters and the completely mad true religious believers. But with no implication that we will all therefore become either intense ICT consumers or that everybody will become an ICT knowledge worker. Look at consumption first. By 1998, 50% of Americans already had a personal computer and 30% an internet connection. But total ICT consumption, and this includes, by the way, plain old voice telephony, which is actually quite a large percentage of that, was still only 2.4% of GDP versus 1.9% back before all this new paradigm in 1987, a pretty small change. And I think that figure is not going to go up much in future for a very simple reason. This stuff is very cheap and continually gets cheaper. Computers get relentlessly cheaper and better. Telecom services have close to zero marginal costs. Bandwidth keeps increasing, and eventually we will all have, and it may be only 5 years ago, fully functional video telephones. But when that time comes, we will only pay for those video telephones what we pay today for plain old telephony service. It's the relative productivity and relative price effect we saw in relation to traded goods and in relation to durable goods, but massively more intense when we look specifically at ICT goods and services, precisely because ICT is subject to such rapid technological advance. Think of it this way, a sort of fun little way to think about it. Given the 18 months price performance rule, it is quite possible that in 20 years' time, consumers will consume each 10,000 times as much computing and communicating power as they do today. But it is also quite possible that their consumer expenditure on all that computing and communications power will have fallen, not risen, relative to the economic value of the world restaurant business and to the consumer expenditure on restaurants. That productivity effect has implications too for employment. For while America's ICT industries now contribute, as we saw, 8.2% of GDP, they only provided in 1998 3.7% of employment, because running a mobile telephone company doesn't take many people. Running a software company doesn't take many people, even if everybody in the world buys your product, because software replication is a close to completely costless activity. One reason why ICT companies command huge valuations is that the marginal costs are often absolutely trivial to approaching zero. That may or may not suggest vulnerability in those valuations as prices compete down towards marginal cost. It certainly means that huge volume increases will often be accompanied with either minimal or nil employment creation, which doesn't deny some employment creation in ICT-specific industries. The US Bureau of Labor Statistics forecasts that 3.7% in 1998 will go to 4.8% in 2008, with the increase concentrated almost entirely not in the mobile telephone companies or the hardware producers, but in the computer processing and software services, a subset of business services, a continuation of the outsourcing trend combined with a still more intensive use of ICT in business process design and delivery. But the total percentage will still be under 5%, and there's no necessary reason to believe that the numbers employed will increase relentlessly in the years thereafter. Indeed, as a percentage of the total, they may well begin to fall. And meanwhile, in all those interactive activities we saw earlier, the roughly half, let us say, of the economy made up of administering and invoicing and processing and meeting, huge numbers of employees are likely to lose their existing jobs, the inevitable consequence of that accelerated productivity growth. And indeed, we won't get the accelerated productivity growth unless large numbers of people lose their job. So let's be absolutely clear. ICT is going to destroy more jobs than it creates. End of story. But the good news is that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because a technology doesn't need to create jobs as well as destroy them in order to be economically beneficial. The agricultural revolution destroyed jobs, but the people unemployed as a result found other jobs in other completely unrelated areas of the economy. And that is what should happen and what will happen with the ICT revolution. ICT will automate away huge numbers of jobs, but provided labour markets are reasonably flexible, provided nominal demand growth is kept steady and adequate, and provided major unnecessary demand shocks are avoided, new jobs will be created. And they're most likely to be created from a continuation of the trend to service and servicing intensity, which has been at work for the last several decades. Which is why the US Bureau of Labour Statistics forecast for the next 10 years shows new jobs coming from the following rather interesting combination of sources. First of all, 1.9 million in computer and data processing, the increase in ICT-specific jobs that we looked at earlier. Then 2.75 million, they say, from other categories of business services, of which actually more than a million is from that wonderful catch-all category, personnel supply services, a continuation of the outsourcing trend, but not actually a change in what work people do, nor in what people consume. But then 4.5 million more in hotels, restaurants, cafes, amusement centres, auto hire, auto cleaning, auto parking. Turns out that parking, cleaning and greasing autos is a really quite significant part of the US labour market. It is great to study these things in detail because you can really get to a fine level of detail. And then, perhaps most interesting of all, they say, 4.95 million, the biggest figure of all, from more education and more health and residential health care, which essentially means more nurses and teachers. Now, of course, these are just forecasts, but they fit the existing trends, they fit what we know about fundamental economics, and they're highly likely to be at least directionally correct, which leaves us with a sort of paradox, but a paradox which should not surprise us, which is that in this increasingly ICT-intensive world, while it's certainly true that almost everyone will use ICT to some degree, many of the most rapidly growing jobs will be, in some senses, high-touch rather than high-tech. More nursing staff, more cooks, more teachers, more amusement park entertainers, more sports centre professionals. A more high-touch world quite as much as a more high-tech. But the apparent paradox should not surprise us because it's just another example of the relative productivity growth, relative price factor, which we've now encountered three times in this lecture. Traded goods and services constrained as a percentage of GDP because we keep on increasing their productivity so much that they continually fall in relative price. Durable goods falling in relative price to offset even a very rapid volume growth. And ICT, above all, precisely because it is capable of massive productivity improvement, self-limiting as a share of total economic activity, and tending to increase over time the share of the economy accounted for by everything which we cannot automate or do not want to. Let me finish with some thought starters and provocations. Conclusions and hypotheses prompted by this analysis, but certainly not proven by it, and with some thoughts, too, on where real problems of public policy lie and where they don't. First assertion, there is no inherent problem of job creation. There is no lump of labour, and it doesn't matter that ICT destroys more jobs than it creates because other jobs will emerge. Which, of course, at one level, and if we speak of the long term, is almost axiomatic and also not very helpful, because it actually matters rather a lot how long the long term is and how smooth is the transition. Agricultural jobs, after all, were, yes, eventually fully replaced, but only with some rather large social upheavals along the way, as we digested the consequences of that huge loss of jobs, offset eventually by huge creation. So Let me make the first assertion a little bit more extreme, just to provoke, and a little bit more interesting. That transition will, in employment terms, be quite smooth, because transitional structural unemployment is reducing as an economic problem for two reasons. First, because one of the byproducts of the shift to the service economy is that we no longer start, when we face a shock, with large regional concentrations or industry-specific concentrations of employment and skill. Regional economies throughout the developed world are getting more similar. The types of jobs that they have are a more and more similar mix of a bit of manufacturing and then all the different slices of service economy that you normally have. That's one factor. The second is specific to the technology. And it's simply this, that ICT, because it is so pervasive and general, that means that the job shakeout as a result of ICT is not going to be concentrated in any one specific sector or region, but is pervasive throughout the economy, occurring pretty much in all sectors and all regions simultaneously. We will have a big job shakeout and big job creation, but we'll have a smoother transition with less inherent mismatches than in previous major technological shocks. Assertion one. Second assertion, Europe's big problem remains labour market flexibility and neither productivity nor competitiveness. Yes, it is true that Europe is a few years behind the US in the ICT revolution, but really don't worry about it as an aim of public policy, because there's an awful lot of powerful private forces acting to limit the size of that gap. There's an army of entrepreneurs looking to seize the ICT opportunities. There's lots of profit incentive to make sure that, those opportunities get grasped. And because globalization has created immensely effective mechanisms for the rapid transfer of best practice, every idea that anybody has about the internet in the US is going to get replicated in Europe with a gap which will never be longer than 18 months or 2 years. Europe will gain that productivity boost from the ICT revolution, whether politicians decide to make speeches about it or not. The open issue is simply whether it will free up labour markets fast enough to create new service sector jobs at the pace required to achieve a reasonable level of employment. Third assertion, it's not the economy stupid. That the classic problems that governments have always worried about of overall growth and inflation and employment trends, though of course still important, are not actually the difficult issues of public policy today. But instead, here's two out of a list of the tricky issues that we do need to worry about. First, the growth of education and health expenditure. Remember how health spend kept rising in the US and how education was a key driver of employment growth. Richer people want to spend a higher percentage of their income on health and education. But if health and education are primarily publicly provided, that desire can come up against the countervailing desire to hold down taxes. The natural course for a rich economy is for health and education spending to rise as a percentage of national income over time. Either that means more taxes to pay for public provision, or less expenditure on other categories of public expenditure, or more private provision. But that choice will need to be made, because otherwise we are trying to put a hand up against a natural tide of customer preference. And second issue, inequality. There isn't a problem of job creation, but there may be a problem of the income levels at which new jobs are created, both because of the rise of the service economy and because of ICT, which may both be factors significantly increasing income inequality. Certainly, it's notable that while employment in the ICT industries in the US is only increasing slightly, this is actually 1990 from 97, and these figures are as a percentage of total industry and therefore slightly, of total private industry and therefore slightly different from the total economy which we saw earlier, whereas the employment has increased only slightly from 4.4 to 4.7%, those jobs are not only much better paid, taking even in 1990 7% of total wage and salaries, but increasing at a faster rate, taking increases in wage and salaries, and that's even before you allow for the fact that a large element of remuneration in IT industries is also in the form of stock appreciation. So I think there could be, for a whole set of reasons, a much greater problem about how we think about income inequality than how we think about job creation. Nor do I believe that the standard response, let's equip everyone with ICT skills, will prove an adequate answer, even though I certainly believe that we should do that. I think it's worth posing, final thought, that employability, the ability to get a job, may be a function of the absolute level of skills that you have, but that income distribution is to a very large extent a reflection of relative skills. And the incremental value of higher relative skills seems, for a variety of reasons, to be increasing significantly. But that, as I'm sure you'll be all pleased to hear, is another story. Thank you.
Well, thank you for a terrific lecture with so many interesting insights, nicely related by one common theme. Who'd like to start? Questions, comments? Make it short, please.
My name is Alan Main, author. Two basic questions. One is, has the economic theory, which is used to address this problem area, taken account of non-equilibrium economics, which would seem to me to be imperative in view of the dynamic nature of the changes? Second point is, what are the likely effects on hours worked in jobs? Because that's another factor which hasn't been put up on the board.
Thank you.
Right. Well, I think I might actually avoid the first question, which is how much the economic theory used to address this has taken into account of non-equilibrium economics. But since I am a, as it were, lay economist rather than the present academic, I don't actually feel qualified to know what the answer to that is. The likely effects on hours worked, I think, is an interesting one. I mean, the basic hypothesis that I have is that there is no lump of labour. And as I say, I think that is almost axiomatic. I'm one of these people that finds it just very difficult to understand other people who believe that there is a lump of labour. I've always wanted a debate with sort of Martine Aubry, but I fear it would be a dialogue of the complete deaf. So I don't think there is a lump of labour. But what that doesn't mean is that we should therefore not accept a fall in hours worked. I think it's very important to have an attitude to hours worked which sees that as a natural consequence of people's individual decisions. And that's why I was very, very careful when I put up the two challenges of economic policy, that the right-hand one was not a maximum level of employment, but a maximum level of involuntary unemployment. If it is the case that, for instance, the French lower employment rate is the free product of, whether in terms of people working or in terms of hours worked, is the free product of a set of individual decisions making a different income-leisure trade-off than Americans make, then we should respect that. We should neither fall into the trap, which some Europeans fall into, of believing that there is a lump of labour which has to be rationed out by an enforced reduction of the working week. But nor would we fall into the trap, which I have to say some people totally in love with the American economy fall in love to do, which is to treat it as axiomatic that a 73% employment rate is better than a 65% employment rate, and that a larger number of hours worked is better than a smaller number of hours worked. I think we should treat the number of hours worked and the employment rate as the product of free decisions that people make. And I think that it is perfectly sensible for individuals over time, as they get richer, to take some of the benefit of that in a leisure improvement. One final thought, just a sort of idea thrown in, because it's an interesting one. Some of the value creation of the new internet economy will naturally take the form of leisure. And it'd be interesting to see what people do with that. One of the ways that the new internet economy improves productivity is that it improves the productivity of consumer household work by massively reducing time spent on all sorts of search processes involved in shopping. That's an interesting effect because it means that as long as people simply use that for more leisure, and I believe that Webvan in California now advertises on the basis of a slogan that says, "We'll give you your Saturday mornings back." As long as they actually take that in more leisure, this would be an interesting example of a major increase in consumer utility, of which we will see no sign in measured GDP statistics. We'll only see it in measured GDP statistics if everybody faced with that leisure goes out and finds new jobs and new income to do.
May I ask ask Mr. Adair, how will compliance with the Kyoto Agreement on the environment affect the creation of jobs?
I am a complete optimist on the environmental side. What I didn't say earlier was that if you were asking about real issues for the government in my theme of it's not the economy, stupid, I'd have put environmental and transport issues very high up as difficult issues that they're going to grapple with. But overall, I'm an optimist because I think the point about the Kyoto Agreement is that overall it doesn't create a problem at all. I mean, the fact is, we can meet the Kyoto targets and lots beyond it, provided we thump up the price of energy. I mean, free markets are great things. They react to price signals. And we have huge opportunities to, over time, provided we give long time periods in advance to private industry to respond, to make substitutions between energy, or to make energy-saving activities. And consumers will do the same. If you told people now that the price of petrol in 15 years' time was definitively going to be 10 times its present level, you'd do all sorts of things through to what the type of cars that people are developing in the auto manufacturers. There isn't a fundamental problem. And indeed, the good news is that a lot of what is going on in economic growth at the moment is in some essential forms less environmentally harmful than key elements of economic growth in previous phases. The key problem is a one of the unit at which we make these decisions. There is an overwhelming case, if you could get it, for a worldwide, agreed, very large energy tax. There is a difficult case, there is a very good case for a European-wide energy tax. There is a difficult and complicated case for a UK-wide energy tax. And the issues all become those of what if other people don't do the same, and what is the impact upon the competitiveness of specific sectors. But at the overall macro level, I'm an optimist. I don't think there is any conflict between either job creation and environmental responsibility, and indeed between prosperity and environmental responsibility.
I just wonder why you... Thanks so much. Your projections of employment growth in education and health as being for quite rapidly rising employment, yet these are sectors which use information technology very intensively, yep. And some people have even argued that education will be one of the spheres most heavily affected by information technology through distance learning and things like that, which have been put forward as mechanisms to generate enormous savings in employment in those in that particular sector. Do you think distance learning is...
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, and it's one of those things which I thought somebody would pick me up on, because I think the answer is there is within education very different categories. And I think the way it works is that there are some areas where we will not use technology. We will not use technology to teach 5 to 7 year olds. I think the basic proposition that if you teach 5 to 7 year olds, one of the absolutely key determinants of the quality of output is to get the pupil-teacher ratio as low as possible is pretty much definitively proved and fits with any reasonable theory of how young people, young children learn. I think at the level of university, it is probably right that there is a huge technological opportunity to increase the productivity, and that there may be a completely dynamic. In a sense, there are all sorts of complexities there that need to be looked at, but I think the key is to look at it sector by sector. In health, I think the interesting thing is that if you really look beneath those health figures at where the big increases are coming from, they're actually coming from things which is not primary critical healthcare, but residential healthcare. They're basically about caring for elderly people. And there, I think, you do have a consumer value which is very difficult to automate away. You have a consumer demand for human contact. That is one of the crucial things that people are after. And again, therefore, within the whole picture of health and medical, yes, we should be able to produce dramatic improvements in the productivity of all the administrative and overhead and interactive processes involved in the health service, and those are large. Yes, there is the ability to use remote surgery and things like that to dramatically improve capacity utilization of scarce resources, but the thing which will probably overwhelm that in the other direction is the simple demand for face-to-face nursing care.
excuse me for not standing. It isn't worth the time because my question will be very short. Why should politically sensitive policymakers take seriously for a second the advice of someone like yourself who regards the pain which will be caused by the fallout you've described so graphically as not important? It was important historically because people died and they suffered in other ways, and they will until they get into other areas of the economy. To what extent have you addressed that, and why do you persist in thinking that it doesn't matter?
Well, I guess what I think is, and I touched upon this in the bit where I hypothecated the idea that, of course, transitions matter. I mean, anybody who said it didn't matter that agricultural employment in Europe fell from 60% of the workforce in 1900 to 25% in 1950 because they all found other jobs would be seriously ignoring sort of the rise of fascism and communism and a couple of world wars and things like that. Transition difficulties matter to a very extreme extent. What I argued, however, and to a degree it's a provocation, but I think it's true, that these transition experiences are now much less than they used to be. And I think they're much less than they used to be simply because, first of all, as the economy gets rich, it gets more diversified. It doesn't have huge concentrations of people doing the same thing. It's an interesting fact to think that if you go back to the labor force of, say, 1926, at the time of the general strike, it was of the region of 14 million, of whom 2 million did, I think, three things. They were either miners, or they were railway workers, or they were dockers. And we had these huge concentrations of sort of 750,000 people doing exactly the same things. And so when technologies came along and automated away those jobs, those huge groups of people in geographically concentrated areas, you had catastrophically difficult social effects. But actually, as an economy gets richer, we don't have any one particular category of people do which is a similar percentage of the total. We have much greater diversification in occupational categories. Secondly, we have much less regional variations in categories. If you went back to the 1920s, you could definitively say that Glasgow or Newcastle were about shipbuilding. Huge percentages of their total economic activity involved in one activity. If you actually look at the breakdown of what people do region by region in the UK now, it is much more similar than different. Every single one of them will have a service percentage of GDP somewhere between 85% in the southeast and maybe as low as 70% in some other regions. But there are none which are 60% dependent on manufacturing. And that means that that vulnerability has decreased. And further, as I said, the nature of ICT is that it doesn't come and wipe out a particular region or a particular industry. It has an equal effect all the way across. Now, what I hypothesized is that that therefore creates an easier transition in terms of number of jobs. And I think the thing that proves that is the US. The US is going through this change, not only with no rise in unemployment, but with an extraordinary increase in employment rates, with sort of 70-year-olds being pulled back into the labor force because people need them to do the jobs. So I think the transition in those terms is important. But what I said at the end is that I think the real issues are issues to do with income inequality. And I don't think we can combine a reasonable optimism about the transition in employment terms without an important weather eye open to what it is doing in terms of relative income levels, which is why I would propose flexible labor markets, but combined with fairly generous levels of things like income support systems for those in work, precisely of the nature which are being pursued by this government with the working family tax credit.
Hello, Anthony O'Keefe. Interested in the implications, could you comment, for rural areas, peripheral rural areas, for example, the Highlands and Islands of Scotland?
Well, that's a tricky one. I mean, you can argue it either way, can't you? There's a lot of talk in the Highlands and Islands about how they can get all these knowledge remote workers. I see that there's a British Telecom advert which has a man on his sort of ISDN home highway at a beautiful croft down on the edge of the lake, etc., the loch. And there's an element to that. The death of distance should create some categories of activity which enable a greater degree of dispersion of at least some activities, particularly of some relatively high-income, high-skill activities. I think, though, on the whole, the changes I've suggested don't have all that many consequences, either negative or positive, for some of those remote rural areas. I think what we are probably seeing at the moment with the agricultural decline is the final twist in the decline of the relative income of rural areas, driven essentially, as these things are always driven, by relentless productivity growth. I mean, the reason why the price of agricultural products is collapsing is that we've just got relentlessly more efficient at producing more and more out of the same amount of land. And that is relentless. I suspect, however, that although there's a lot of noise being made about it at the moment, it's an effect which is sort of 90% played out in any case, and that we are already further than we realize along the path to the diversification of most rural areas, except for one or two, towards diversified service economies. But I guess the implication, if there is an implication, it's that in those remote rural areas, don't fool yourself that there's an answer in a prop-up or a reform of change the common agricultural policy, which is going to stand in the way of the relentless fall in the economic value of primary goods production. It's not. It has to be all about creating in those areas sustainable levels of diversified service employment.
Well, thank you very, very much. Such an interesting talk and discussion. I can see this is going to be a tremendous book. I can reveal that this book is being dictated into a computer, which presumably means that you're a lot more productive than most of us who write books.
I can tell you that it is being dictated, as was this lecture. It turns out that ICT, or ICT, as my computer understands it, therefore, is not a technology, but something drunk in the southern states of America. I hope to deal with these glitches before I actually go to print.
Thank you very, very much.